Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. When I was a lad, 1960, say, Philadelphia had three daily newspapers. They had the Bulletin and the Inquirer, for people who could read without moving their lips. And they had the tabloid Daily News for people who could not. Anyway, one of the Philadelphia papers had a great cartoon, a single panel job about the foibles of modern life. You know, like the guy who couldn't possibly let your car go past before pulling onto the highway in front of you, who then proceeds to drive 10 miles an hour below the speed limit so he can read the Daily News and eat breakfast while he drives. The title of this comic was, They'll Do It Every Time. Less amusingly, when a corporate-controlled government sets about deceiving, defrauding, and killing its citizens, you're tempted to observe, they'll do it every time. The same thing in the same way, supported by the same lies and excuses. They call the same plays from the same playbook over and over. And why not? The plays work well. The citizens aren't taught much history. The media present the news totally lacking in context. This is happening now, they tell us. They never tell us something remarkably similar happened 10 years ago, and 20 years ago, and 50 years ago. And here's how it went back then, and here's what happened next. So, all the media report that then-President Bush made a speech. He said, if we don't fight the terrorists over there and win, we'll have to fight them over here. The media never reminded the citizens that President Johnson had said the same thing about the Vietnamese in 1966. Truman said it about the Red Chinese in 1950. Roosevelt said it about the Japs, quote-unquote, in 1941. Woodrow Wilson said it about the Hun in 1916. Polk said it about the Mexicans. And I wouldn't be surprised if Andrew Jackson said it about the Canadians in 1812. James Madison. In each case, the likelihood of fighting the enemy on the beaches of Atlantic City or Malibu was small. And each time the president said it, the press presented the statement as a new insight and a pearl of wisdom. A Chumbawamba song has the great triplet, when two men meet on the field of war, they both ask, what are we fighting for? And haven't we heard it all before? Here's another thing they'll do every time. American wars cost its citizens a fortune. Support the troops, we shout on cue. But the trillions of dollars we pay for war don't support the troops all that much. They support profit for the owners of the war industries. Meanwhile, the White House and the Pentagon send the troops to Mosul without the protective armor for their Humvees, without tourniquets in their emergency medical kits, with shower facilities in their barracks that have shoddy electrical wiring that electrocutes our soldiers. They force the troops to serve 4, 5, 6 tours of duty until they're broken in body or in mind. Then, when these citizen soldiers are no longer useful to the war machine, the government discards them, refuses to provide the medical care they need, and covers up the staggering statistics on veterans' mental disorders, homelessness, and suicides. They'll do it every time. And, as we shall see today, they've been doing it for at least 100 years. We'll hear from journalist Aaron Glantz, who has just published a book on Iraq-Afghanistan veterans' struggles to get medical care for their war injuries. We'll hear from Vietnam veteran John Curry, leveling the same charges in 1971. And we'll hear the words of General Smedley Butler, leveling the same charges about our veterans of World War I. Let's hear first from John Curry, holder of the Silver Star and 3 Purple Hearts, speaking to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, April 22, 1971.
The problem of veterans goes beyond this personal problem. Because you think about a poster in this country with a picture of Uncle Sam, and the picture says, I want you. and a young man comes out of high school and says, that's fine, I'm going to serve my country. And he goes to Vietnam and he shoots and he kills and he does his job. Or maybe he doesn't kill, maybe he just goes and he comes back. And when he gets back to this country, he finds that he isn't really wanted. Because the largest unemployment figure in the country, it varies depending on who you get it from, the Veterans Administration, 15%, various other sources, 22%, but the largest figure of unemployed in this country are veterans of this war. And of those veterans, 33% of the unemployed are black. That means one out of every 10 of the nation's unemployed is a veteran of Vietnam. The hospitals across the country won't or can't meet their demands. It's not a question of not trying, they haven't got the appropriations. A man recently died after he had a tracheotomy in California. Not because of the operation, but because there wasn't enough personnel to clean the mucus out of his tube and he suffocated to death. Another young man just died in a New York VA hospital the other day. A friend of mine was lying in a bed two beds away and tried to help him. But he couldn't. They rang a bell and there was no one there to service that man. And so he died of convulsions. 57%, I understand 57% of all those entering VA hospitals talk about suicide. And some 27% have tried. And they try because they come back to this country and they have to face what they did in Vietnam, and then they come back and find the indifference of a country that doesn't really care. That doesn't really care. And suddenly we're faced with a very sickening situation in this country, because there's no moral indignation. And if there is, it comes from people who are almost exhausted by their past indignancies, and I know that many of them are sitting in front of me. The country seems to have lain down and accepted something as serious as Laos. Just as we calmly shrugged off the loss of 700,000 lives in Pakistan, the so-called greatest disaster of all times, we are here as veterans to say that we think we are in the midst of the greatest disaster of all times now, because they are still dying over there, and not just Americans, Vietnamese. And we are rationalizing leaving that country so that those people can go on killing each other for years to come.
You got that yellow ribbon stuck on your age too. Thanks for the support. Memorial Day weekend, you threw a barbecue. Thanks for the support. I can feel the love 7,000 miles away. And I'm a patriot, as I was trying to say when you cut me short. Thanks for the support. I was gunning for Osama, and you sent me for Saddam. Thanks for the support. I just sat down to dinner. It's another can of Spam. Thanks for the support. You say, complete the mission. And I say, count on me. 'Cause I don't even know what mission there might be to abort. Thanks for the support. You sent me here a third time, and my house was repossessed. Thanks for the support. Now my wife is in a trailer, but she sent a Kevlar vest. Thanks for the support. And I think of her only every time I bleed. And someday we will meet again at Walter Reed, the resort of last resort. Thanks for the support. You hired those mercenaries who make 8 times what I do. Thanks for that. And you showed up on Thanksgiving with a turkey and a camera crew. Thanksgiving. Now you're giving guns to the ones who shot at me. The tank is full, but the strategy might be down a quart. Thanks for the support. And I appreciate the stopgap, and I appreciate the surge. Thanks for the support. Another 20,000 voices to harmonize this dirge. Thanks for the support. And to the Democratic Congress who could have sent me home, who must have come down with a new Gulf War syndrome of some sort. Thanks for the support. If I die tomorrow, won't you ship me home at night? Thanks for the support. And if I have a funeral, make sure it's out of sight. Thanks for the support. In the final seconds, you've got a plan to win. It's cut those taxes and let Jesus put one in from half court. Thanks for the support.
That was Roy Zimmerman. Before that, we heard part of a great speech to a Senate committee by retired Naval Officer John Kerry. In 1971, Kerry spoke of the folly of the Vietnam War and of the atrocities U.S. soldiers regularly committed, sometimes by orders. In the portion we heard, Kerry describes the shabby treatment returning veterans receive from the government, including the shabby medical care they receive for their war injuries. Well, they'll do it every time. Here's journalist Aaron Glantz speaking of how the Army and the VA alike today are doing the same damned things to our soldiers and veterans, only worse.
Then I'm going to talk about the battle that our wounded soldiers have to fight with the Pentagon before they even leave the military. And finally, I will talk about the battle that our veterans have to fight with the Department of Veterans Affairs to get adequate benefits when they get out. And that's why I decided to call the book The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, because we make our veterans battle for every single benefit we promise them when they sign up. The first battle that our veterans have to fight is the battle just to be heard. I'm going to give some statistics. We have 1.8 million veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to the RAND Corporation, we have 300,000 veterans coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression. We have another 300,000 veterans coming home with traumatic brain injuries. This is physical brain damage often caused by roadside bombs. We have 400,000 veterans of these wars who are already out of the military and have filed a disability claim, who say they are disabled from their wartime service. We have hundreds of thousands of American veterans who are already out of the military from these wars and using the VA's medical services, especially its psychological services. And these are statistics that we almost never hear in the media. And the reason we never hear them is because the Bush administration had been very careful to not tell us and to only give this information out to aggressive reporters and lawyers who sued to find out what these statistics were. Otherwise, there's no way that we would know that 80,000 Americans have had to be medically evacuated out of the country of Iraq or Afghanistan because their wounds were too severe to be treated on the battlefield. Under President Bush, people who spoke up and talked about these statistics and urged a public dialogue and urged the administration to do something were fired. Anthony Principe, George W. Bush's first Secretary of Veterans Affairs, came forward and said to George Bush, when he started this war in Iraq, "Mr. President, you have started a war. You need to hire more doctors. You need to hire more nurses. You need to hire more psychiatrists and disability claims adjusters at the VA." And he was fired. Dr. Francis Murphy, hired by the Bush administration's VA to do a mental health assessment to survey our VAs and figure out if they were doing a good job caring for our returning veterans. She found out that mental health care was so inaccessible as to be worthless. She was also fired. Who got promoted? Well, when Anthony Principe was fired as the VA secretary, a guy named Jim Nicholson was brought in. Jim Nicholson was a real estate developer from the great state of Colorado who had managed the Florida recount campaign of George Bush in the year 2000 and had no particular expertise in health care. Dr. Ira Katz, the head of mental health under President George W. Bush, when CBS News started to investigate the number of suicides amongst our returning Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, Dr. Katz wrote an email to a VA spokesperson. The subject line was "Shh," S-H-H exclamation point. He went on to say, "Don't tell CBS News that 1,000 veterans under our care attempt suicide every month. We have to find a way to spin this thing." That was the attitude of the Bush administration. Why did they have this attitude? Because they had to sell us the war. Remember Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense? I know he's not necessarily a fond memory. He told us that the war might last 6 days. It might last 6 weeks. He doubted 6 months. And here we are 6 years later. If he had told us that this war would go on for 6 years and we'd be looking at 400,000 disability claims, 18 suicides a day by veterans, if he told us that we would have 300,000 people coming home with PTSD and another 300,000 coming home with traumatic brain injuries, maybe we wouldn't have gone for this war. And so they did everything they could to sweep the war under the rug, to sweep the casualties under the rug. And this had a very material effect on our wounded veterans' ability to get care. Another thing that has had a very material effect on our veterans' ability to get care is their inability to get out of the military after they've completed their service. During the Vietnam War, we had a draft, and almost everyone who served in Vietnam had to serve one tour, and they came home 1 year to the day that they set foot in Vietnam, they were back on American soil. In this Iraq war, we have people going 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. We have 700,000 Americans who have served more than one tour in Iraq or Afghanistan. This is not easy. This is not what human beings are meant to do, fight in wars forever with no goal in sight, no end in sight. And part of the problem is not only that we have stop loss, not only that the inactive ready reserve is being called up, it's also that the military has been under such pressure to get bodies to the front that they simply disregard requests of people when they ask for help. And when it becomes clear to them that a soldier is not able to function, the commanders often diagnose them with a personality disorder. We have tens of thousands of American soldiers who have been given dishonorable discharges for having a personality disorder after serving in Iraq or Afghanistan. In other words, people come home, they can't sleep at night, they start drinking, they start engaging in destructive behavior. The response should be from the military, this person clearly is suffering from combat stress and needs help. But instead, all too often, the military says, you have a pre-existing condition. You have always been crazy. You were crazy even before you went to Iraq, and now we're going to get rid of you and not give you any benefits so that we can make room for the next guy who's going to be more useful for us. Another thing that happens, that's happened to thousands of our veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, is that they come home from the war and begin to engage in destructive behavior, beginning to drink too much, beginning to do drugs, maybe get in a domestic violence incident with their spouse. The police have to be called. And then they get a dishonorable discharge for this behavior. I write in the book about Don Hanks, who was stationed down at Fort Lewis. He was a staff sergeant, served 14 years in the United States Army, including a tour in Iraq, never had any problems over those 14 years. But after he got home from Iraq, he was trying to tough it out, started smoking marijuana, failed a urine test, and was dishonorably discharged with no benefits. Well, I talked to him about a year ago. He was cleaning the windows on skyscrapers here in Seattle, and he liked it. You know, he liked to be up above the city all by himself where he had some room to think and wash the windows. But he really needed to get into some kind of healthcare system, and that was unavailable to him because he had received this dishonorable discharge for failing this urine test. And the situation is even worse when the military doesn't want to let you go. When they force you to go back to Iraq, when they don't listen to you when you say you need help. I just finished writing an article about specialist John Fish, who lived in San Luis Obispo County on the central coast of California. He told the military that he was depressed during his first tour in Iraq when he was 17 years old. He came home. He told the military commanders that he was suicidal. And they didn't believe him, and they ordered him deployed to Afghanistan for his second tour. And so during the training exercises for his second deployment, he wandered out into the New Mexican desert and shot himself in the head. This is why we have more suicides now in the month of January than we did combat deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. Even when you get out of the military, when you are finished with your fighting, then our system requires you to fight yet another battle just to get into the Department of Veterans Affairs. If you come home from the war and have post-traumatic stress disorder and you want to get into that system, the very first thing that the government makes you do is fill out a 26-page form where you have to not only describe the traumatic incident which has traumatized you, and your symptoms, but you also have to get letters from your battle buddies or your commanding officers corroborating that these incidents actually occurred. And people who help veterans fill out this paperwork advise them to file a Freedom of Information Act request on themselves and copy their congressman to make sure that they have all the documents on themselves that the government has on them. And then the veteran gathers all of this paperwork together and submits it to the VA regional office, which then sits on it. And the average wait time, if there's no disagreement between the veteran and the VA, is 6 months to 2 years. And if there is a disagreement, if the veteran decides that he or she wants to appeal this decision, is 4.5 years. The wait is so long that we now have 600,000 veterans waiting to find out if they are entitled to disability. We have, in the 6 months that ended on March 31st of last year, 1,500 veterans who died waiting to learn if they would get a disability check. And for our returning Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, this wait time is critical, because it can be the time that they either recover from their war injuries or they spiral out of control. But the problem is that our government is not set up to be friendly. It's not set up to say welcome home. It's set up to battle our veterans.
But it didn't start in Vietnam either. Here's retired Major General Smedley Butler writing in 1935 about the soldiers and the veterans of World War I. But the soldier pays the biggest part of the bill. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States. On a tour of the country, I have visited 18 government hospitals for veterans. In them are a total of about 50,000 destroyed men. Men who were the pick of the nations 18 years ago. The very able chief surgeon at the government hospital at Milwaukee, where there are 3,800 of the living dead, told me that mortality among veterans is three times as great as among those who stayed at home. Boys with a normal viewpoint were taken out of fields and offices and factories and classrooms and put into the ranks. There they were remolded, they were made over, they were made to about face, to regard murder as the order of the day. They were put shoulder to shoulder, and, through mass psychology, they were entirely changed. We used them for a couple of years and trained them to think nothing at all of killing or of being killed. Then suddenly we discharged them and told them to make another about-face. This time they had to do their own readjustment, without mass psychology, without officers' aid and advice, and without nationwide propaganda. We didn't need them anymore. So we scattered them about without any three-minute or Liberty Loan speeches or parades. Many, too many of these fine young boys are eventually destroyed mentally because they could not make that final about-face alone. There are thousands and thousands of these cases, and more are coming in all the time. But don't forget, the soldier paid part of the dollars and cents bill, too. Having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to make them help pay for the war, too. So we gave them the large salary of $30 a month. All they had to do for this munificent sum was to leave their dear loved ones behind, give up their jobs, lie in swampy trenches, eat canned willy when they could get it, and kill and kill and kill and be killed. But wait! Half of that wage was promptly taken from him to support his dependents. Then we made him pay what amounted to accident insurance. That cost him $6 a month. He had less than $9 a month left. Then, the most crowning insolence of all, the soldier was virtually blackjacked into paying for his own ammunition, clothing, and food by being made to buy Liberty Bonds. Most soldiers got no money at all on paydays. And the soldiers bought about $2 billion worth of these bonds. Yes, the soldier pays the greater part of the bill. His family pays, too. When he returned home minus an eye or minus a leg or with his mind broken, they suffered, too, as much as and sometimes even more than he. And even now, the families of the wounded men and of the mentally broken and those who never were able to readjust themselves are still suffering and still paying. That's all for now. New World Notes comes to you from WWUH-FM at the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed are mine alone. Thanks to Mind Over Matters for the Glantz recording and to democracynow.org for the John Kerry. Have a good week. Illegitimi non carborundum. And remember, they'll do it every time. So it's easy to catch them at it. Ciao.